So I'll begin. Who's here last night too, by the way? Okay, this is going to make it easier for me. I always like to ask these questions because I don't like to assume who's in the room. It doesn't usually work very well. So I actually love both sides of the fence in mindfulness. I am a Dharma teacher. I teach early Buddhism. I'm from the Theravada tradition, insight meditation, early Buddhism, Pali Canon, all of that school of thought and practice. And I really like that kind of work. It's a big part of what I do. I'm very interested in early Buddhism from an academic perspective, and there's a lot of really exciting things happening in that regard. We have people like Bhikkhu Anayo, who's been doing all this work on Satipatthana, which is the teachings and four foundations of mindfulness. We have all these academic people like Andrew Olinsky and John Peacock and Stephen Batchelor, who are really looking at the Buddhist teachings through a cultural lens and an etymological lens, and really trying to make the earliest teachings as accurate as possible. And that's I'm a big proponent of accuracy. I really want to be able to teach and understand what the Buddha might have taught as closely as what he might have actually said. And also, this is always going to be some degree of, like, we just don't know. So that's a big half of what I do. I'm also very interested in Buddhist psychology, and I've been trained, and I study this manual called the Abhidharma, which is the compendium of mental factors, which is part of the Pali Canon, which is all about Buddhist psychology. But there's one missing piece, I think, in early Buddhism that doesn't translate well into the modern paradigm. Is in most schools of Buddhism, and certainly early Buddhism, there's no like Pali term, or there's no way in which they use this word that we use called emotion. There's no Pali translation, there's no... It's kind of where the world, there's kind of some confusion about that. And so in the Western paradigm, in our lives, in our world, in our culture, we are very much informed and understand and talk about, especially therapeutically, this word emotion is a big part of our lives. So personally for me, if I'm honest, and I look at my experience in my life and being in recovery and having trauma and having really a lot of struggles, the area of my life that has been most challenging and the area of life that I've suffered the most for me has been in the emotional domain. Like, psychologically, I'm actually pretty good. Me and my mind are, like, pretty good. Healthy level of respect for each other. I fortunately don't have any really physical pain or physical sensory difficulty so much. My relationships are really quite good. I do pretty well with people in general. Unless emotion enters the equation. But that's the area where I really want more. I want more information. I want more data. I want more understanding. And my Buddhist practice, mindfulness practice, has been very limited in trying to tease that out. Like, they don't talk about sadness in Buddhism. They don't really talk about fear so much. Disgust, contempt, these kind of physiological emotions. And when we look at the teachings of mindfulness, in the area where emotion might fit best is in the third foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of mind states and attitudes, and I would add emotion. Is in Satipatthana, what they're asking us to really look for are these three qualities of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the Buddhist endeavor is one in which we're trying to uproot and to overcome and to not be dictated by greed, hatred, and delusion, which makes a lot of sense. I'm greedy for pleasure. I want things to go a certain way, and I can get into some controlling around that. And that can cause me a lot of problems, and has and does. Also hatred. And greed and hatred, very strong, potent words, right? Hatred, or just this resisting, this tendency to push away unpleasantness and to avoid difficulty. And then delusion, which is a very difficult word to translate or to understand by its very nature. Delusion, you mostly don't know when you're delusional. That's what delusion is. But I feel like that's a little bit almost of a barbaric analysis into what we struggle with. It's not, for me, it's not definitive enough. The vocabulary, I want more than that. And so if we look at emotional intelligence, which really was informed by Buddhism, I'll be honest. Daniel Goleman, whose son I grew up with, and I have a relationship with that family, and so I have a personal kind of interest in that. His family was really good to me, and really actually Daniel Goleman and his ex-wife Anasuya were the people who actually got me interested in meditation and brought me to the Insight Meditation Society, where I met Joseph Goldstein and Stephen Smith and some of my first teachers. So I do have a sense of gratitude to them. But he was a science researcher and a Buddhist practitioner. He's one of the people who's very instrumental in bringing mindfulness and vipassana and insight meditation to our culture. Daniel Goleman, Richard Davidson, Ram Dass, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg. There's a whole crew of these people who went to this Goenka retreat in the late 60s in India and learned vipassana, and that's really the beginning of how all of this started. And so it's really great that we have this mixture. We have Richard Davidson and Daniel Goleman, who are more on the science side of it. And then we have these great teachers like Joseph Goldstein and Jack, who have really kind of taught the Theravadan method of meditation. And I'm very liberal, and like I like to have as wide a view as possible and to not be dismissive of certain things because they don't fit into a category or they don't fit into my preference system. So in 2000, the Dalai Lama sort of enters the equation. They had this meeting in India, in Dharamsala, and I think it was in 2000. And what came out of that was this book called Destructive Emotions. And the meeting was it's a great book, you can get it. It's called Destructive Emotions, I highly recommend it. It was a meeting between the Dalai Lama and people like Matthew Ricard and Alan Wallace, who's a famous Buddhist teacher in America. Richard Davidson was there, Daniel Goleman was there, Paul Ekman was there. It was a bunch of scientists and meditators and Buddhist monks and the Dalai Lama, and they had this big meeting about how can we help people in a way that is going to help them overcome their emotional suffering. And the Dalai Lama, one thing I really appreciate about the Dalai Lama, I'm not a big Tibetan practitioner, I don't know a lot about Tibetan Buddhism, but I do know the Dalai Lama is one of the most biggest proponents of secular ethics and really trying to make Buddhist practices more secular so that people who don't ascribe or have that Buddhist leaning can be able to benefit from these practices. And it's interesting because I think if we think of who's the most Buddhist figure in our world, most people know the Dalai Lama. They say, oh, the Dalai Lama, he's like the Buddhist Pope or something, right? Like we know him that way. But he's very secular in his views and his perspectives. And he wanted to have a conversation about what is it that people struggle with, what's going on with these emotions, how can we offer vocabulary. And what came out of that meeting was a book called Destructive Emotions. And the premise of Destructive Emotions was to try to be very realistic about what it means to be awakened, what it means to be enlightened, and really, from a science and a Buddhist perspective, how much can we actually expect, or what's realistic in terms of dealing with emotions? Because they seem to be what people suffer with the most. And honestly, I would say that one of the things that has been guilty of Buddhist practitioners, certainly in American culture, is this idea that that enlightenment or awakening or Buddhist practice leads to some sort of like emotional lobotomy where we just don't feel unpleasantness anymore. That like if we get really good at this business, that we'll be liberated and we'll wake up, we'll be enlightened, and we just won't have any disturbing feelings emotionally, psychologically. And almost we've created this paradigm where Buddhist enlightenment, for lack of a better term, is sort of like Buddhist heaven. And like if we like can just meditate properly, we'll get to a place where we don't have to deal with any unpleasantness at all. Have you kind of thought about it that way or seen that kind of across the culture? And completely unrealistic. So that being the case, what they wanted to do was to see what is the science of emotions, what are the benefits of meditation. And really one of the things I think that's very interesting about our culture now from a clinical perspective or from a mental health perspective is if you just look at the way we diagnose mental and emotional anguish, is we've really derogatorized all of it. So we're very interested in Western psychology on how bad people do, right? You know, anxiety, depression, trauma, stress, and there's so many disorders now. Like every day, like there's a new disorder that comes out. Opposition, ODD, and it's just like every time somebody does something that's difficult, they create a new, you have this now. I can't even keep up. And then you meet, God forbid, you meet an American teenager and they tell you what their diagnosis is. It takes 45 minutes. They're like, well, let me pull out my thing. I have doo-doo. And it's just like, we've really pathologized suffering. We've pathologized mental anguish, mental stress, emotional difficulty to the point where I would say that we've declared a kind of cultural war against any unpleasant mind state or emotion that people have. And that if you're sad, well, sit down, what's wrong with you? Well, we need to give you some medication. You're having sadness. You shouldn't be having sadness. You should be happy. How come you're not happy? You should be happy all the time. You're not happy? Something wrong with you. And that really sets us up for, it disconnects us from our humanity. It's tragically unrealistic. And I'll leave this aside, but I will say, what has arisen out of this paradigm is a multi-billion dollar pharmacology industry. And they are very interested in how bad you're doing because they can invent a profit tool to benefit from your unpleasant experience, from a subtle to a gross. And also I do want to say that I think that there are lots of benefits to medication and that it's not all bad, but it has definitely become overly prescribed, and there is this attitude, if you have a hard emotion to deal with, that there's something that will fix that, so just take this thing. And you know, the idea that meditation or Buddhist practice is not interested in, it's interested in the other side of that coin. It's not interested in how bad people are doing. It's very interested in how good can people do? How well can we be? So Buddhism's all about well-being and very interested in what is the human potential? How good can human beings actually do? And so Richard Davidson's very interested in this, and he has a whole science laboratory where, you know, he takes Matthew Ricard and these what they call Olympic level meditators, these Buddhist monks who have been meditating these practices for years, and puts them in a laboratory and checks the cortisol level in their saliva and hooks them up all these to machines. And when they did the first study on Matthew Ricard, he had so much gamma in his prefrontal cortex that Richard Davidson thought the machine was broken. He was like, this can't be right. This dude's like, he's like, our machine is broken. This guy's like, has this massive real estate in his prefrontal cortex and has access to these parts of the brain way more than the thousands of people that we've studied. So then it becomes, how well can human beings do is a great question. In what are the practices, what are the things that people can do to be able to incline that way? You know, and it's like, you know, a tree that, as the Buddha would say, as a tree grows and leans to the west. If it's leaning to the west, when that tree gets cut down, it will fall to the west. And so if it leans to the east, when it's cut down, it will fall to the east. So we have to look at our mental and emotional leanings because we end up inclining ourselves in a particular direction. Are we inclined towards suffering or are we inclined towards well-being? What are the conditions that lead to people being inclined towards suffering? What are the conditions that lead towards people to be inclined towards well-being? And what they found, and I've noticed this as somebody who's spent the last decade or so, for many years I was teaching 300 meditation classes a year. I was teaching meditation in jails and prisons and treatment centers and youth detention centers. And one thing that I noticed quite quickly, and I've always been fascinated in, is really what seemed to be the biggest problem in the room was emotion. You know, people talk about things like anxiety, depression, and stress. But when you talk further and you track it down to what is it that drives anxiety, depression, and stress, which are kind of the three big offenders, right? I don't know if anybody here write treatment plans? It's like the first thing you do, you just automatically assume anxiety, depression. I've never seen a treatment plan that didn't say patient struggles with anxiety, depression, and stress. And I would argue that every human being on the planet probably struggles to some degree with anxiety, depression, and stress. Right? And that's more of a psychological thinking aspect of it. But really, when we follow the trail of breadcrumbs more closely to the somatic experience, we oftentimes see that there's always, not always, but often an emotional engine that's driving these psychological functions. Right? This is why people with PTS and really advanced stages of complex trauma, talk therapy is basically irrelevant. You know, people with trauma can sit there and they can relive the story, they can tell it to you 1,000 times and it actually doesn't do much. It might actually exacerbate the issue. So there's something in the human experience that does lurk below the psychological aspect that does have a somatic aspect to it that we would call emotion. And there also, maybe in very clearly, there's also a nonverbal component to emotion, like in the right brain, which is sensations, emotions, iconic, meaning, symbolism, symbolic, which is an area that I'm very interested in, is what part of the mind is the meaning making? I don't know about you, but every time something happens, I always ascribe meaning to it. Like I told the story last night about there being at LAX and not having my ticket. And I was like, well, what does that mean? It means that I'm a stupid person who can't do things right. It's like I'm always ascribing something. So where does that come from? What's the meaning making? Why am I always having to make meaning of everything? Why does everybody love a sunset? And most people do. There's probably people who don't, but we'll talk about that some other time. But people love a sunset. Why do we love sunsets? I don't know, we just do. There's something meaningful about that. There's something iconic about that. There's something emotional about that. Maybe it's a sense of gratitude or a sense of beauty. But there is this aspect of human experience that we know very little about from a Western perspective. Buddhism maybe has a better analysis of that in these heart practices. But we have to kind of start to see where we incline and where we lean. So one of the byproducts of mindfulness practice is emotional intelligence. And if you practice mindfulness, you're going to just organically end up having more access to your emotion. You just are. You sit quietly, you meditate, you bring awareness into your breath, into your present time experience, and you're just going to have more access to emotion. Now, that can go a variety of ways. Sometimes it's like, I don't actually want that. I've actually got into meditation practice for the specific reason of avoiding that. I don't want to have access to shame and sadness and disgust. Right? But that's what happens. And so what they started to recognize was the way that we talk about emotions is we talk about them in black and white. We would say things like, we have good emotions and bad emotions. Or we have wholesome emotions and unwholesome emotions. Or we have positive emotions and negative emotions. And we all, and I've fallen into the trap of teaching that way, positive emotions, negative emotions. But again, just that labeling strategy derogatorizes certain aspects of our emotional experience. Anger, bad and wrong. Especially if we get into Buddhism. Gotta uproot hatred. Well, hatred and anger seem to be closely linked. So now, if I'm gonna be a good Buddhist, I'm not supposed to be angry. Don't get angry. Right? And now I become conflict avoidant, or I become inauthentic, or I allow people to manipulate and control me because I think anger is bad and wrong and I'm not supposed to have it. Right? Where I grew up in Northampton, we used to have this term for people there, we used to call them aggro hippies. They were like these people who would be like super spiritual and friendly, and when they got mad, they would lose it. Because they had all this, like, you know, and as a punk rocker, I used to be like, let's see if we can get the hippie guy angry. Which isn't cool, but, you know, that's a whole other time and another place. Because we all have certain emotions that we would prefer to not feel. Right? If I could go to the hospital right now and get an emotion removed, I would just get that right out. If we could just get that one out, that'd be cool. So, you know, and we all, you're probably doing it right now in your head, right? Like if you could get any or which one of them removed, right? And so what they wanted to do is they came up with a very beautiful, useful paradigm to how to view emotion. And that emotions are either a destructive emotion or a constructive emotion. And it's not the emotion itself. So we might say, well, shame is destructive and sadness is destructive and anger is destructive. It's not the emotion itself that's destructive or constructive. It's our relationship to that emotion. So Buddhism would say, and this is kind of an interesting thing, like let's go with a very basic one, anger. Now, anger, typically speaking, is an emotion that we would think of as a negative emotion, or maybe we have anger problems. Some people have too much anger, certainly, but some people have not enough anger. Because if you look at the evolution of emotion, is that every emotion that we have was, we were evolved into that emotion for a particular reason. So that they're there to be, they have a strategy, they have a role in the system. And the role of anger is to remove an obstacle. You have any obstacles in your life that you would like to remove? Mm-hmm. You know what emotion you need to remove those obstacles? Anger. So we have to be able to use anger, but we have to be able to use it constructively, not destructively. And if we look at our lives, we could probably give examples of how we've used anger constructively in certain situations. In other situations, maybe we've used it the opposite. We don't always get it right. So Buddha's perspective would say that a constructive relationship to anger would look like compassion. And when I think of compassion and I think of anger, I think of them as being opposite. But they're actually not opposite, they're actually conjoined. Because if I want to be a compassionate person, a lot of times what has to, like, so compassion, the nature of compassion is to some degree to set a boundary. Like, I got clean and sober off drugs and alcohol because of anger. I was so angry and so pissed off about how crappy my life was going. I was like, I'm just not doing it. I was so angry that's what I used to stop that behavior. And, you know, maybe there were some destructive aspects of it, but it did actually work. So if we have a constructive relationship to anger, that looks like compassion. Because we care. Compassion is rooted in this human quality of caring, and we all care about a whole wide range of things. Right? So if we kind of if we reverse engineer that, well, why do I get angry? Well, I get angry because I care. And it's something that I care about, like my family, my friends, something I believe in. Anytime something that I care about becomes threatened or attacked or belittled, I get angry. And so what I need to do is be able to use that anger constructively so that way I can take the appropriate action to not cause intentional harm, but to protect that which I care about. That takes some anger. I almost feel weird saying that, but it's actually true. So that way we have to be able to use these emotions in their intended purpose. So we would say, do we have a constructive relationship to anger or a destructive relationship to anger? And if we reflect on our experience, it's probably a mixed bag. I'm sure you can give me examples of where you were constructive in your anger, where you were destructive in your anger. And so what they did is they looked at, the Dalai Lama wanted there to be a very scientific aspect to this and how meditation practices can help. And so they did Paul Ekman was involved in this, and he sent out a letter to like all the emotion scientists around the world. I think there was like 270 people, and they identified that all emotion scientists agree on 5 basic primary emotions: anger, fear, sadness, joy, and disgust. It's actually, you ever see that movie Inside Out? You should totally see this cartoon movie called Inside Out, because the 5 characters in the movie are based on the 5 basic emotions: joy, anger, fear, sadness, and disgust. Right? And they did take out 2 that I really like, which was contempt and surprise. And Ekman also agrees that those are primary emotions. So what can be very helpful in this capacity, and one of the things about this cultivating emotional balance training that Paul Ekman and Alan Wallace designed about 10 years after that meeting, his daughter, Eve Ekman, who's a good friend of mine and a colleague of mine, teaches, and I'm getting trained in it next year. I'm very excited about it, is being able to understand the physiological aspects of these emotional experiences. And so that there's these very primary emotions, and then there's also secondary emotions, and then there's more complex emotions. So like shame is not a primary emotion, but shame is like a combination of maybe anger and disgust, right? And I would argue, working with people in substance abuse, to me what seems to be one of the primary problems is the destructive relationship people have with shame, right? And the way that we derogatorize, if that's a word, shame. And I think most people would think of shame, well, shame's a very negative emotion. It's a very destructive emotion. It's a very bad emotion. It's just not. It's just an emotion. Emotion has no, dare I use the word, moral or ethical. From the view of science, and I think also from the view of Buddhism, actually, is emotions are essentially benign. They're just there. We all have them. We all have the same ones. If you study people from around the world, everybody has the same emotions, and every human being makes a facial expression the same way. Disgust, which is interesting, because disgust is about, the role of disgust is to remove something toxic. And I'm one of those people, I must have eaten something bad when I was a kid, because I always smell my food. Like if I open up the carton of milk or out of the refrigerator, I always smell it. And what do you do when you smell? You go. And that's the universal sign. Whether you're from France or Italy or Ohio or an Aboriginal tribe in the outback of Australia, every human being makes the same facial expression with those particular emotions. So there's a physiological aspect of emotion that can be felt somatically. We all experience shame the same way. When you get shamed, you're standing there, you feel it run up the back of your legs, up your back, comes over the top of your head, your face lights up, and you get red. Ever had that happen? Every human being on the planet experiences the physiological experience of that emotion exactly the same. Regardless of your history, regardless of everything, that's how it was represented somatically in the system. I think that's really fascinating and quite interesting. So we are really, you know, stuck with these emotions. So we have to learn how to, if we want to use mindfulness, and I was talking to Daniel about this yesterday, one of my favorite things to do now as a mindfulness person, who also believes that mindfulness is very limited. So if mindfulness is limited, we have to ask the question, for what purpose should I cultivate mindfulness? Why? Mindfulness, why? What's mindfulness going to do for me? To help me be better at breathing? Help me recognize all of the things in my life that are going wrong? Why? And of course, in the Buddhist paradigm, we say, well, mindfulness and the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and dependent origination. And we can get into all these kind of lists because Buddhism is a list-worshipping religion, which I like, actually, because I'm a list person. I love a list. And I think the reason why there's lists is because the Buddha was just really organized, and he organized everything through lists. But if we go more, I think, pragmatic and more secular in the terms of this time, of this era, of this world in which we live, my argument is, and kind of the mode that I'm moving into in mental health in a clinical domain, is mindfulness for the purpose of cultivating emotional balance. That's why. Mindfulness for the purpose of developing emotional intelligence, being able to identify an emotion. How helpful would it be for you if you were in some situation where you got triggered and you had mindfulness and you're like, oh, I feel sad right now. Okay, well, mindfulness of sadness. Okay, well, I know here's the drop-down menu of destructive behaviors I engage in when I'm sad. Maybe stay away from those. And here's some maybe constructive things I can do when I'm sad. And also knowing the psychological narrative that you have. What's the sad self story? I'm a person who's sad. I'm sad because the people in my life died, and I'm sad because you all have a narrative. And when I work with people, when I work in emotional intelligence, I have people write a narrative about their emotional, like write me a story about the sad self. Write me a story about the angry self. Write me a story about the scared self. Write me a story about the disgust self. Just give it, and people are like, well, all the stories are different. The story I tell myself about myself when I'm sad is completely different than the story I tell myself when I'm in joy. Right? When I'm happy, I have this great narrative about this guy, Dave Smith. When I'm experiencing the emotion of joy, my narrative, my self-view, really good. I don't have much bad to say about this guy. I'm like, yeah, man, you're so good. I like you. You do it. But when I'm sad, When I'm experiencing the emotion of sad, in my psychological experience, the narrative that I tell about myself, a way different story. In fact, if you looked at them, you can almost say they're polarized. So if we look at, like, you know, the Buddhist paradigm of life is, you know, joy and sorrow, just kind of the life is 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. There's a polarization in that, because the story that I tell myself when I'm in joy and the story I tell myself when I'm in sadness are very opposite stories. So which story is true? Well, they're both a little bit true, and they're both a little bit kind of inaccurate. Right? So being able to identify, that's what emotional intelligence is. It's being able to identify the emotion that you're having whilst you're having it. Right? That's it. And if you think about it, you're probably like, oh, I'm actually not so good at that. I don't know what it is. And also it's important to recognize that we're not always emotional. That most human beings have anywhere between 5 and 12 emotional episodes throughout the day. Some of them you're aware of. And the range of the emotional episode is very, very subtle to very, very gross. So maybe it's good to know, what are my emotional hot buttons? What emotions do I have? What emotions do I do well with? What emotions do I not do so well with? And this stage model of using the four foundations of mindfulness to integrate into the four stages of emotional intelligence is a really, really great pragmatic tool. And then if you add the Brahmaviharas to it, it's even more effective. So being able to identify the emotion that you're having whilst you're having it. And the second stage of emotional intelligence, which is the hardest one, is being able to access that emotion. Actually being sad and letting your whole somatic experience feel the sadness. It's like, I don't know, I came here to get away from all that. As a Buddhist teacher, it's interesting because people come, they're like, yeah, how do I... You only get two questions as a Buddhist teacher. You get a question of, I notice this happens and how do I get rid of it? That's one question. And the other question is, I heard this can happen, how do I make it happen? Which, there's two questions. There's the craving question and the aversion question. How do I get this and how do I get rid of that? And every question I hear, I'm like, I just hear it through that lens. I'm like, yeah, you don't like that, you want to get rid of it. That's not going to work. Damn it. That's why I came. We have to be able to access emotion. We have to be able to access shame and disgust and contempt. We have to be able to know how they feel in the body. Are they hot? Are they cold? Is it in my face? Is it in my feet? Where is it? How is it? Mindfulness of the body. That's where that emotion is. Access that emotion. And then if you can do those first two, which are the hardest two, then you can begin to understand emotion. And you can begin to manage emotion. And, you know, mindfulness and emotional management, that's a really great framework for why one might want to practice. Because if you could ask a million people, say, would you like to have more mindfulness? They might say, yeah, I don't know, maybe, who cares? I don't know what mindfulness even means. But if you ask people, would you be interested in learning how to manage your emotions? Most people would go, yeah, totally interested in that. And how do you do that? Well, you do need mindfulness. Mindfulness is the greatest skill and tool and ally we have in managing the emotions. But it only gets you into the room. And then having this other practice or other, and there's lots of ways. And I'm also very big fan. There's so many great therapeutic interventions that help people manage emotions. There's DBT and there's CBT and there's internal family systems. And anybody who works in therapy already has a whole great set of tools on how they help people manage their emotions. But for me, a system of training using mindfulness practices for the sole purpose of helping people manage their emotions, in this cultivating emotional balance training system, it just gives you people a very kind of nice linear system on how that works. By defining and understanding the basic emotions, understanding how they arrive, how they feel physiologically, it's going to make it much easier for you to recognize it when it's happening. Because what happens is we get triggered. We get an emotional trigger. And usually when we get an emotional trigger, we lose our emotional management system. Like, I can sit here and give you a great lecture on how to manage your emotions. But when I'm triggered an emotion, it goes offline. I'm just like, oh man, I don't know what to do. I lose that skill. Because what happens is usually when an emotional onset happens, is we get startled, the amygdala gets kicked on, and we go into that fight or flight aspect of the brain, the prefrontal cortex shuts down, and now I'm in this kind of, you know, ancient system of fight and flight, and I don't do well. So the question is, how can I stay in that prefrontal cortex? How can I arrive into mindfulness and stay in mindfulness and manage that emotional experience? So the more I practice mindfulness, the more access I have to mindfulness. And the more I practice emotional intelligence and understand these emotions, when I'm in that moment of the arising or the onset of a distressing emotion, I have better ability to go, oh, okay, I just got triggered. I'm oh boy, I'm feeling it. Take some breath, relax, what's going on? Oh, I feel contempt for this other person. Okay, that's all right, I feel contempt. What's that about? Staying with it. And the hard part is, and the bad news, and this is the last thing I'll say, is the rub is managing emotions is difficult, man. You know, it's not going to be pleasant or easy much of the time. Emotions are these deep-rooted physiological experiences that are oftentimes carry with them a degree of stress or some anxiety or some challenge. So we have to get out of this idea that mindfulness, that present time awareness, will guarantee pleasant time awareness. Because part of mindfulness is to recognize unpleasantness and then learning how to navigate through that system in a way that is constructive rather than destructive. So I want to save some time for some questions and comments, but that's where my thinking is now, and I'm very interested in this, and I'm glad that you guys are here with me today. So thank you.